Good afternoon. It's Saturday, January 3rd, and you're listening to The LaRouche Show. My name is Bruce Director, and I will be your host. This is, of course, the first LaRouche Show of 2015, and I'm joined in the studio with noted author and historian Anton Chaykin, who's known to many of our listeners here as the author of Treason in America, the author of the unauthorized biography of George Bush, which was famous for helping to defeat George Bush's re-election in 1992, which saved the country. And since we're on the first show of 2015, this is the year where the world is waiting with great dread at the possibility that another Bush may run for president, Jebby Bush, probably one of the more corrupt of the Bushes, although the whole family is corrupt. And we're happy to have Anton with us today because he has written a new article about the history of the United States, which is in the latest edition of the EIR. And you can get that online at www.larouchepub.com. And this article is vitally necessary to help us burn the latest Bush. So welcome to the program, Tony. It's good to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Let's start actually on that note. I mean, it is a very real serious threat to the country that another Bush is going to try and capture the White House. And this is not just the second son of a former president or the brother of a former president, but he actually is a part of a whole lineage that goes back quite some time and has been a real threat to the United States since basically the turn of the century, or even going back into the middle of the 19th century. And this really puts us in a situation where we see that we're right now in a real fight over what role the United States is going to play in the world. Throughout our history, we've played a role as a positive force for mankind and looked seen as a beacon of hope, a temple of liberty, the last great hope for mankind. And yet our country has increasingly gotten to the point where we're seen as a force for evil in the world, partly because of the Bushes, who, as agents of the British Empire, have been exercising influence over American policy for now many years. And in her New Year's address yesterday, Helga Zepp LaRouche, the wife of Lyndon LaRouche and the founder of the Schiller Institute, said that Americans really have to come to grips with the fact of how much the esteem of the United States has plummeted around the world, and that if we could free America from Obama and from Bush, that and get back to our traditional history and our traditional position in the world, that the whole world would be extremely happy. So we're here to open the new year by mobilizing the listeners here to give the world that happy New Year's gift of getting rid of the Bushes. So let's start with that, Tony, since you're an expert on the Bushes. Tell us why the Bushes are so bad and this latest Bush has got to be burned down.
Well, Jeb stands for Just Evil British. And the crucial thing to understand there is that this is a miniature banking dynasty. That is, it's not really a power as a dynasty in banking, but it is bankers, and it's part of the ruling enemy oligarchy of the transatlantic financier axis from the City of London to Wall Street. That is the Bush family. That's what they are.
And when you say bankers here, you're not talking about the traditional conception of an American banker who takes deposits from people and pays interest on those deposits and then loans out money to businesses and agriculture and homeowners and so forth.
Correct.
So what do you actually mean by banker? Maybe a better word is financier or predator or parasite or money changer.
Those things are all useful, but they miss the central point. And I've just Executive Intelligence Review has just published an article I did on the background of our fight with this oligarchy in our history, our successful fight in terms of developing the power of our nation and other nations, and an unsuccessful fight in the sense that the enemy has power over our country at the present time. The basic myth and lie that has to be confronted in understanding this subject is the worst American myth that is believed in by the right wing and the left wing both. And this is the lie that speculators and other capitalists created American industry. Just because, and this is, I'm going to give you the lie in its full force.
Okay, and when you hear this this lie, you should be, listeners, you should be really searching your soul to see how much of this you might believe or rest in the back reaches of your mind. So go ahead, Tony.
Because they were ruthless and cared only for profits, they were efficient and effective enough to build up America's economic power, leading to our high relative standard of living. The fact is that speculators and mere capitalists built no American industry. And the power that rules Wall Street did not care for only profits. In fact, they didn't even primarily care for profits. I'm talking about those who guided Wall Street. Unlike the mere speculators, those that directing the events and the credit flows had global objectives, and they were war-related objectives. That is, they were political objectives. And you have to consider Bush in that context, both in terms of how the Bush family was created in the later years of this Wall Street power, which is in the 20th century when they arose as stooges and managers for this gang, and then also to go back and consider again the question of the objectives.
Okay, before we go back to the history, which I want to get into because this is really important for people to understand this, why don't you put this in the context of what's happening today? Lyndon LaRouche has been saying for a long time, but especially in the recent period, that the world is right on the edge of thermonuclear confrontation, which could wipe out the entire human race, and that this pressure for driving the world into the up to the trigger point or across the trigger mechanism for thermonuclear war is the fact that this Wall Street crowd that you're talking about is absolutely bankrupt right now, and that they see no alternative to bankruptcy but war, even if that war is going to wipe out the human race. So put what you just said into context. Why is that? What's the connect? You mentioned that the bankers have global objectives, and these are war objectives. How does a war objective help speculators and financiers and oligarchs and so forth?
Okay. I want to introduce this answer by saying that I've been at the side of Lyndon LaRouche for almost 50 years now, and I've seen his mind develop and his ideas influence the world over the course of that time. The fundamental concept that he introduced when we started this was that the financial powers of Wall Street and London we're looking at the developed industry and infrastructure and productive capabilities of the world as a revenue stream and as a lever of power to be used for their own interests, but that they could never actually continue to develop or actually enforce and bring about the further existence of that productive apparatus. They weren't interested in that. So they are basically, they've been in control of it for quite a long time and have gradually and now increasingly bankrupted the productive machinery of the world. That's the concept that LaRouche introduced to start this movement 50 years ago, mm-hmm. when I got in with him. And at this point, that bankruptcy, the physical and potentiality bankruptcy of the whole Western economic sphere, is manifest to everybody. Everybody can see it. It's losing credibility very, very fast. Under those circumstances, there's a madness in this oligarchy, in this old, tired oligarchy. You see the tiredness in the British royal family. Who are these people? You see this in the leaders of speculation and the leaders of social engineering. It's pure madness now. The radical environmentalists, the lunacy in various fields of legalization of drugs and so forth. So under those conditions, they're not so much looking to grab a hold of Russia and China and India as they come up as great powers and take over their money or take over their industry. They're berserk in trying to level any new attempts to produce productive industry. And if you look at the basis of their own power, it was originally taking over the wealth and power generated by patriots, generated by productive industrialists.
Okay, so in today's world, we have this situation where you have this transatlantic system that you just described, completely bankrupt. You look at Europe, every country in Europe is completely bankrupt. And the austerity that's been imposed by the bankers, by these oligarchs, in reaction to this bankruptcy is just killing people, is destroying the industry and so forth in Europe. And you have a similar situation in the United States. Now, at the same time, we have something else happening in the world, which is the development of the BRIC cooperation around the BRICS nations.
Yeah.
We have, as our listeners know, the famous meeting last year, in the middle of last year, in Fortaleza, Brazil, where the BRICS nations met and agreed to form a new bank, the Asian International Development Bank, that the BRICS nations, led by China especially, are investing in massive forms of new technology and infrastructure and raising the standard of living. You have cooperation between Russia and China. You have major developments happening in India with the election of the new prime minister there, Narendra Modi, who is dedicated to developing it. So you have this conflict between the investment of human intellectual capacity in improving the conditions of life and extending man's progress centered in the BRICS nations in this collapsing transatlantic system. Does that characterize why there's this conflict for war?
Yes, and you saw this kind of war without nuclear weapons threatening. So now it's more dangerous, but you saw precisely this kind of war internally in the West in the previous period, for example, in the article that I did, and later in the period of Franklin Roosevelt, when the enemy developed fascism. That's all developed by this Anglo-American financier gang. So this kind of war in the period of the 1870s that I cover in this new article was between those who are trying to come out with the vast power of new technologies, particularly electricity, petroleum, transcontinental railroads, chemistry, all new forces in the world. And the enemy oligarchy that's built up with new points of view of darkness, real beyond feudalism that were developed in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s that later becomes fascism. At that time, they're trying to stop this. And that's when these families were put into operation as powers here, namely Morgan and Rockefeller, to go against and try to stop American industrialization. These later became both social engineers as members of this oligarchy and British viceroys in Wall Street. And they are the people, along with the Kuhnlobe Bank and the British royal family itself, that set up the Harriman Bush Bank and created the Bush family in the early 20th century.
So let's now get into the details so that people actually get the get this picture. And of course, we're not going to have time today to go through the whole article. This is no substitute for people actually reading and studying your tremendous article, which again you can get on the EIR website at www.larouchepub.com. But let's start with this. But I think in order to set the stage for this period in the 1870s, maybe you should give our listeners a little bit, go back a little bit further, because the 1870s is the immediate aftermath of the U.S. Civil War, which was not a conflict internal to the United States. So correct. I guess the prologue to this is, that was also part of this war drive. And so why don't you just go from that and tell us about what happened in the 1870s?
All right. Well, I'll give a little bit of a background first that we have to consider in this history certain things about credit. And that is the control of credit flows, the directing of a national revenue stream, the change in the volume of credit, the character of the products in the national revenue stream, whether they're productively useful or destructive, and the effect of the product's character on the soul of the population. Before the American experience, you have the buildup of the City of London in the 1600s and 1700s, completely based on destruction. Mm-hmm. It was buildup on Guinea, African slaves, and gold. The slaves come to Carolina, which was set up by John Locke and the British, and the gold, the guineas, go to London. That's mm-hmm. the creation of these firms in London, the City of London. And it's pure menticide. It's pure plunder.
And give us the names of some of those firms, because I think they might...
Barclays Bank is one of them. Oh, Jeb Bush just resigned as a $1 million a year consultant to Barclays just now, a week ago.
So these are familiar names to us today.
But also Baring Bank, the Hope family, the East India Company, and the Royal African Company. These are jointly owned by the British royal family and the great nobles and bankers in England and Holland.
And these banks, which some of which still exist today, were created and developed purely off this human trafficking.
Yes, and they have two objectives. One of them is controlling credit and thereby controlling nations. And the other is policy control. That is the use of intelligence and political methods such as assassination and various Venetian and Roman methods for imperial control. So these are banks and everything else in control of a society. It's all one. In England, you have to understand this now. This is crucial. There is no public and private in England. There's officially public and officially private, but it's merged in, for example, in the Privy Council, so that the same people sit in judgment on the banks, the state religion, the universities, the newspapers, the shipping, the military, the intelligence agencies, the royal family itself, and on, so forth. Mm-hmm. Even the sexual morality of the population, this kind of thing. Right? This is decided upon in discussions at Cambridge. Mm-hmm. Things like that. Mm-hmm. So at this point in the 16 and 1700s, this gang, first of all, Africa was annihilated in the slave trade, like a nuclear war. And it was decided at that time that countries like Ireland and India, and America to a certain extent with slavery, would be subjects of menticide and be destroyed. So we had a revolution. We had a political and economic revolution, the first of which was our American Revolution with Hamilton. And we got control over the flow of credit. We started to encourage private credit from abroad and start to build up our own internal infrastructure and so forth. This was not creditworthy and credible until we had a successful buildup of infrastructure and industry for the first time in a second policy revolution in the 1810s and 20s, so that Hamiltonian economics was actually implemented and the free trade policies of Jefferson were overthrown. So then we started to actually build up. We had a takeoff of industry and infrastructure. There were two centers. One was Philadelphia and the other was New York. And this was on the basis of coal, canals, iron production, and machine industry, things like this. This is all driven by nationalism. It was a policy revolution. One thing to consider at this point, and this is what we should look forward to with the BRICS, is that in this policy revolution, first the American Revolution, then this wonderful policy breakthrough in the 1820s, a new generation came up, young people looking at this national development of progress and saying, my God, the horizons are expanded, we can do anything. Abraham Lincoln, born in 1809, was 16 to 20 years old at the time of the greatest developments in this 1820s, when the Erie Canal was built and John Quincy Adams was president. And then he saw, and in his young adulthood, the destruction of this by Andrew Jackson and the Depression of 1837, the destruction of national policy. And so this is burned into his mind. Look at our potential. In the period that I'm covering in the 1870s, in this article, you have a second policy revolution after the success of Lincoln in the Civil War.
Let's just stick with this, for the first one. Okay, so we had this policy revolution, then you had the rise of Jefferson and Van Buren, which were British agents.
Jackson,
I mean.
This is the second time through this crap.
Right, Jackson.
Worse than the first one. And the much British worse agent. Than Jefferson.
Absolutely. And the British agents, Van Buren, we had the Depression of 1837.
Yeah.
This sense of progress, and then that you had this conflict came to a head, ultimately leading to the Civil War. Is that correct?
Yes, and think about the time just before the Civil War, when the character of our country, just like Ireland and India, was under a racial imperialism. What was the product of the United States in that 30-year period? It was not for our use. It was slave cotton exported, 75% of it exported to England through Wall Street. This is the beginning of Wall Street, which is just like the beginning of the City of London. It's dominated by the products of slavery.
So first they made the money from the slaves themselves, and then they made money from the products of the slaves.
That's right. Money, but not building up the power of the USA.
Right.
This is another myth that people said, well, slavery built the United States. No, slavery was crime that was destroying the United States.
Right.
Slavery was genocide of Africa and menticide of black people in the USA, and really crippled the thinking of a whole generation of people in the 1840s and 50s in our country.
Right.
And in Ireland and in India at the same time, under the same Hitlerian conditions in those countries.
Right. But unlike India and Ireland, we had the previous success of our revolution and
yes.
the input of Alexander Hamilton, the legacy of George Washington, that was manifested later by John Quincy Adams. This is a whole nother show.
Yeah, sure.
But it came to a head with the American Civil War. You mentioned Abraham Lincoln, who was the leader that saved the country. And just so to set the stage for our listeners, the American Civil War was not a civil war. It was actually a world war with these European oligarchical powers behind and backing and supporting and creating the whole Confederacy movement. And that was crushed with the American Civil War. The fact that, right. that Lincoln successfully retook our country and crushed these oligarchical powers defeated this whole Wall Street operation. So we're talking about the aftermath of that is what the period this article right. deals with in the 1870s. So now tell us about what actually happened. Okay, we've won. We've had this great victory, except that Lincoln was assassinated by a British conspiracy. And now the war is over and the country has to continue the progress. What happens?
In the war, remember that the leaders of policy, including Henry Carey and the nationalists, are thinking of Ireland and India. They're thinking of this whole background. This is the soul, the national memory is open during the Civil War, as it was had been during the Revolution. And we're thinking and dreaming of humanity and of our own past and of the wrong that's being done to the world at that same time by our enemies in Britain. So at the end of this war in 1866, we begin a period of about 15 years of the most rapid progress the world had ever seen or heard about. It was at this time that America was not only looked upon with favor by other countries as a potentially wonderful place, but was seen as the marvel that was shaking up the universe.
And what? Give us a couple of real quick examples which illustrate that. One that comes to my mind is the Transcontinental Railroad, but that's just the most famous one.
Right. It is just the most famous one, and it's a policy triumph that was later more and more useful. But, for example, we created a steel industry from nothing. We had no steel industry before Lincoln, and then suddenly we're producing millions of tons of steel. We created a chemical industry from nothing. We created an oil industry from nothing, all by science and technology and policy in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with Texas or some foreign country. It was the same policy revolution. Machine making. There was a company in Philadelphia called the Baldwin Locomotive Company. And I point especially at that in this article. It was the world's largest capital goods company, paid the highest wages in the world, had a completely visionary and successful apprenticeship policy. There were no managers in this company. There were no managers. They were partners who owned the company. It was a purely private enterprise, and they were all specialists. Each one of them was an expert in the technology in some aspect of the business. And then they had the most skilled workers were made a foreman in the different shops, and they saved a lot of money by not having any bosses in the factory. That's the American system. Mm-hmm. They hated this Taylorism and speed up and all this other crap. There was a union. The workers had a union to protect themselves like they did in other industries. And there were a few days of strikes. There were three different strikes between 1860 and 1911. The 1911 strike was against Morgan trying to take over the company. Mm-hmm. This company produced 70,000 locomotives for the world.
All over the world. They shipped them all over the world.
Every country that was developing got these locomotives. And crews came from Philadelphia out to Peru and other countries to take these things apart and put them back together again. That was the excitement of the American idea was being exported to the whole world. In this same period then, and I go through this step by step, against the will of Wall Street and London, express will, we developed electricity. And this was in a straight line from Franklin's work into Edison through the Franklin Institute. And I tell the exciting story of how we finally got a national administration in 1881 that for a few months went into action to spring all this new technology everywhere that they could, and electricity got out. The genie was out of the bottle. They did this through the Paris Electrical Congress and Exposition of 1881, done by the U.S. government overseas. Mm-hmm. And we set up partnerships to develop electricity throughout the world. Wall Street was in a frenzy to stop this, and London was after ensuring their people that this wouldn't work. Electricity cannot work. It was out, and they couldn't stop it. So this is the period we are talking about.
So we're talking about a period where the oligarchy, centered in the city of London, sets about to completely destroy the United States, and it erupts into the Civil War, which was designed to crush America,
yeah,
crush this idea, and instead, Lincoln achieves victory in the Civil War. And instead of coming out of the war a devastated mess, the United States becomes the most powerful industrial power on earth by these policies.
Right.
These American system policies. Let me just interrupt here and remind our listeners that you're listening to the LaRouche Show. It's for Saturday, January 3rd, the first LaRouche Show of the year. And we're talking to author and historian Anton Chaykin about the true history of the United States. Okay, so here we are, 15 years out of the Civil War. We reached the 1870s, 1880 period, and the British oligarchy has been completely defeated. America is transforming itself and transforming the world.
It's been defeated here.
Then what does Wall Street do?
Okay, so this is what London does through Wall Street.
Okay.
That's the important thing. So keep in your mind now, we have a whole new generation of successful visionaries. Think of the people I have in this story: Carnegie, Edison, Tom Scott of Pennsylvania Railroad, Joseph Potts of the oil company called the Empire Transportation. Are these people capitalists in the same sense as Rockefeller and Morgan? Mm-hmm. Are Bismarck and the Meiji leaders and Lincoln and Garfield and later JFK or FDR, are they capitalist politicians in the sense that Marxists and British historiographers would have you believe? No, this doesn't make any sense. This history is insane. So well, I'm telling this story from the inside. So what happens in 1872, at the very height of the power of this drive to get the new productive forces out to the world, out in our own country and abroad, the British banking firm, Junius Morgan and Peabody, which are an arm of Queen Victoria's forces, political forces, Junius Morgan assigns his young son, J.P. Morgan, to go to Philadelphia, the heart of this American nationalist grouping, and be set in motion as a partner of a Philadelphia banker, Anthony Drexel, to destroy the American industries and the American industrialists.
And these Morgans are inheritors of the legacy of this slave trade, cotton trade financiers that you mentioned earlier.
His father is a British banker, born in America, but now living in Britain as a British financier, and fully involved with the British policy, imperial policies. His own maternal grandfather, John Pierpont, was a cousin and employee of Aaron Burr, and the tutor for the Burr family, and was in charge of trying to help Burr to set up a succession to Burr in a new empire based on the secession of the West and the South.
Right. Aaron Burr, the person who...
The guy who killed Hamilton.
Who killed Hamilton, yeah. Who was vice president with Jefferson, who was later indicted for treason and fled to England.
Yeah, and then he came back in 1812 and worked with Van Buren to put Jackson and this new Democratic Slavery Party. So,
these are the traitors who were defeated in the Civil War. And not just defeated, but America was free to develop. And they come back in 1872.
72, they set up the partnership, Drexel Morgan, in Philadelphia. His father closes down a small shop that J.P. Morgan had on Wall Street. And they set up this partnership here. And the House of Morgan, as we know it later, is born in 1873, the next year, when that banking partnership in Philadelphia, which runs a newspaper called the Philadelphia Ledger and works in direct partnership with the London Times, runs an international scandal and lie and libel campaign to destroy the banker of the Philadelphia industrialists and of the U.S. government, Jay Cook. This is the guy that raised the money for Lincoln during the Civil War by selling bonds to the public. He's financing the next transcontinental railroad, the Northern Pacific. And there's a lie put out that he is not creditworthy and that he's overextended. This is all done by this little group at which Drexel Morgan is at the center. And there's no doubt about this. This is not some theory. Nobody would deny this that knows any of the facts. This is not... This is something that is simply not polite to discuss, according to our universities and so forth. So the result of this is that in the summer of 1873, Jay Cook was driven into bankruptcy. The entire national productive apparatus was temporarily wrecked. The Northern Pacific Railroad was stopped. The stock exchange closed down in New York for a week. And Morgan made $1 million in this Great Depression of 1873. The Philadelphia Nationalists were bankrupted, including the Pennsylvania Railroad was diminished in power. And Morgan started building this in 1872 in anticipation of victory, a palace in Wall Street, right at the plush location near Broadway. And he became the ruler of Wall Street. He was then transferred out of Philadelphia up to Wall Street. Mm-hmm. At the same time, 1872-73, another guy was put into operation who didn't have the tradition of Morgan in terms of being descended from people working with Aaron Burr and all this mythology of the old intriguers. And the royal blood of the Boston Brahmins or something like that. The Rockefeller, I'm talking about, whose father is a criminal, a petty criminal, elixir salesman, and bigamist. And Rockefeller is a criminal. And this is more and more the character of what is brought in to rule the country through Wall Street.
And Rockefeller, you're talking about
John D. Rockefeller.
The first Rockefeller.
Yes.
Okay, of the dynasty.
All right, so his job, as he works it out in consultation with a British partner, a fanatical royalist guy named Andrews that he meets in Cleveland, and then his brother goes up to Wall Street to get backing. And what he does is he says, okay, there's a new industry in the United States. It's centered in northwestern Pennsylvania near Lake Erie. It's the Pennsylvania oil companies that have been built up by industrialists, especially centered in Philadelphia, running a whole transportation grid for this oil. It's used for machinery, lubrication, and illuminating oil. It's not yet used as a fuel, although that's in the works. At the Centennial Exhibition in 1876, they already have a motor going for this. So Rockefeller says, okay, this is obviously going to come up. It's a huge new industry. American industry. My mission, as Wall Street is funding me with millions of dollars, Vanderbilt and other criminals, and now under the guidance of this Morgan British axis, my mission is to take over the entire oil apparatus of the oil fields, that is the small companies that produce the oil, the sump companies that ship the oil, and to destroy the larger industrial machinery of the Pennsylvania Railroad and their allies that are actually developing the oil industry. And in doing so, make myself a monopolist. And he sets up the first American monopolist called Standard Oil. But this is driven from Wall Street, and it's British policy to destroy the Philadelphia Nationalists.
So by monopolist, you say Rockefeller took control of all the oil production in Pennsylvania?
He got control of it in stages over a period of about a decade. And the first stage is purely intimidation of the oil men. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're not part of our cartel, you'll be crushed and taken over and destroyed and get nothing. So you get to sell out to me. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to intimidate the Pennsylvania Railroad. And finally, he's putting so much pressure on them that they have to cut wages on the Pennsylvania Railroad and cut back services. They're still trying to produce, to help the oil refiners, the small businessmen, and the whole industry. But they have to cut back. So there's a big strike in 1877, the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, which is, in one sense, a defensive strike by the workers on these railroads who are being put under bad conditions, first by this Morgan-induced depression of 1873, and now by the Rockefeller-induced cutbacks of the oil shipments. So they have a strike in 1877. And in this strike, lo and behold, a mob arises that attacks and burns down, guess which railroad? The Pennsylvania Railroad. Did they burn down Rockefeller's stuff? No. Did they attack Cleveland? No. Because this mob is being directed to destroy the American industry at its heart. Vanderbilt, he owned railroads, and his railroads didn't even get struck during this. So
is this like an early version of what today we'd call a colored revolution?
Exactly. It's terrorism and a color revolution. The people who were doing this destruction understood nothing of what they were doing, except probably some of the top leaders of it. But why are historians not curious about the relationship of this massive destruction that caused the Pennsylvania Railroad people to quit the oil industry and give it all over to Rockefeller? Why aren't they interested in the fact that there was this war going on between Rockefeller and Tom Scott at that time, the Pennsylvania Railroad? They're not interested because they're paid by the Rockefeller and his friends. That's why, mm-hmm. including the leftists. Right.
So
Rockefeller Brothers Fund just paid for McKibben's bullshit in New York and other cities of radical environmentalism, Earth Day, just now. Mm-hmm. So this is we have this right now. That's why you don't have the history of this country, the positive history. You don't know about this whole generation of visionaries that grew up in our country and other countries to illuminate the world.
So Rockefeller with Morgan backing is making this play to monopolize the oil industry, and at the same time that he monopolizes the oil industry, which is increasingly becoming sort of a keystone industry for the whole economy.
As our side develop the machines and the industry to use it.
Right. So who's fighting them? What's the resistance? So they get away with this, or is there?
Well, in this period of the 1870s, there's a whole leadership group which I've come to really understand and know pretty much the secrets of by working with LaRouche for so many years, which is around Henry Carey and his friends. There are other people that came from a more New York background in this, but there's a circle there that is fighting them and working directly with the leaders in Germany and Russia and Japan and elsewhere in China. And in 1880, they decide we're going to have to take the presidency. This can't just be a private, influence thing. It can't just be, the LaRouche circle or the Kerry circle having influence in foreign countries. We've got to have the presidency. And so Henry Kerry's right-hand man, Wharton Barker, and a circle of Irish revolutionaries around them get up the candidacy of a Greek teacher, a high school Greek teacher named James Garfield. And they put him up for the presidency. And they run this secret background campaign over the course of 1880 to try to get him the nomination.
And in 1880, Garfield was not just teaching Greek, he was also
a U.S. congressman. Yeah, he had become a congressman, but in 1876, during the centennial, he sat down with his fellow congressman and was talking about geometry, and he worked out a proof of the Pythagorean theorem.
Which is very famous proof of the Pythagorean, original proof of the Pythagorean theorem.
Yeah, using a trapezoid and triangles. Yeah. So in 1880, they run a coup at the Republican convention in Chicago, all stage managed by the Kerry group and these Irish revolutionaries. And then they go out to the Irish community in Boston and New York and Philadelphia and other cities with leaflets saying, do you want to vote for Democratic Party free trade and slavery under England? Look how they've destroyed Ireland. You want them to destroy the United States? No. Put our man Garfield in, and let's have an America that's going to have a great future.
So they
and they won the election.
They
in
won the election. And then what happens?
So Garfield comes in, and immediately goes to war against Wall Street.
This is important because most people don't know this. They think of James Garfield. They don't really have much idea what they do. They know he was assassinated. We're going to get into that in a second. But what did he actually do in the short time he was president?
All right. The most famous thing at that time was that he was told by the leader of the Wall Street faction of the Republican Party, Roscoe Conkling, that he had to put a Wall Street man in his Treasury secretary. And he said, no, I don't want any Wall Street person. I don't want any banker in our Treasury Department, period. And then he appointed a friend of James Blaine, the nationalist, a guy named Robertson, as the collector of the Port of New York, which has tremendous power over Wall Street. They collect the tariffs. They have revenue. They control a huge revenue stream. And they have appointment, patronage. So this was in direct opposition to this so-called stalwart faction of the Republicans that run by Conkling, that the Kerryites and Garfield had defeated at the convention to get him elected in the first place. Now he's putting immense pressure on Wall Street. At the same time, his friends in this Irish grouping have, the ones who actually helped get him elected, have also built a submarine that's being tested in New York Harbor at the same time. And the collector of the port that he puts in there rebuffs a British protest against the testing of this submarine. It's actually the first world's first successful submarine with dynamite-laden torpedoes and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's using one of these gasoline motors that was developed at the first use of a gasoline motor in the world. Mm-hmm. So Conkling actually had to resign from the Senate. He was so destroyed politically. And the other New York senator resigned as well, expecting to be reappointed by their legislatures, which did not happen because the nationalists had full control at that moment. Mm-hmm. So it was at that point, and also that he's in a war with the British in South America, and there's a fantastic alliance with Russia that's going on. I go into details about that. And there is a there's a wonderful background into Ireland for this whole story, which involves the New York Times on the enemy side. There's a wonderful other story. Get to some other time. So the moment that this creature, Roscoe Conkling, the head of the Stalwart faction, is forced to resign as U.S. Senator from New York, a crazed mental slave from a cult commune in New York State named Charles Guiteau, G-U-I-T-E-A-U, begins stalking Garfield. And on July 2nd, in Washington, he's inaugurated March 4th, July 2nd, Garfield was shot by this man, Guiteau, at the train station in Washington. His war secretary is Robert Lincoln, the son of Abraham Lincoln, who's standing there when he's shot. Imagine what's in his mind. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Guiteau, who shoots Garfield, shouts out, "I am a stalwart, and now Chester Arthur is president." Arthur was the protege and stooge for Conkling. So, and he was vice president, and Garfield, so he now becomes president.
And Garfield was only president for a few months. So
he hung on. He didn't die right away. He died a couple months later. And the Nationalists continued their policy in South America and elsewhere as long as they could until they were fired and so forth. But so now let's go, if you want to, do a quick review of how you get the Bushes.
Yeah, that's what you anticipated my question. Because okay. I'm saying, okay, so this is right the period, right around the time where we get the Bushes. But you see, I'd just like to point out, I think what you see in this is that the British oligarchy had one strategy to crush the United States leading up to the Civil War, which failed. And now they, if you think about what you've recounted here, they get a shift in policy. It's realizing they can't crush the United States militarily or with the conventional type of means. They shifted to a new type, these strikes, this colored revolution, these social changes, financial warfare against industries and so forth. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, is the characteristic of the policies of the Bushes, right?
Yes. One other thing we have to mention so that you can keep in mind, which is the great hope of humanity now, is that in this period, just even look at what Garfield did. The week after he took over as president, he and his Secretary of State, Blaine, arranged for American government backing for a great meeting and exhibition in France of electricity. Mm-hmm. And Edison and his Philadelphia managers went, were operating in this exposition and at that Congress. And it was all under U.S. government auspices, State Department and military. And they arranged for, Edison arranged with Emil Ratenau of Germany to set up a whole German electrification. They became the AEG in Germany. And then as partners, Edison and Ratenau electrified the entire world, including Russia. This is a result of this final action by the U.S. government under the Nationalists in 1881. So we have unleashed a new power in the world greater than this bunch of stupid financiers. The greater power is a permanent concept and a permanent success of power over nature to study all levels of creation, including to study man's own powers and to get it going. This is now a new power in the world, and this is unleashed at this time.
And we see this today, for example, in China's tremendous projects, water projects, energy projects, and of course, the frontier of all that is their lunar program, their space program.
That's right.
Where you see this led by China. So now, out of this comes
war.
This war and this waste comes a new weed, which grows into a bush.
That's right. Exactly. So the way this works is...
Which still threatens us today. So let's get to this.
All right. So, yeah, they legalized some kind of
weed. They legalized weed.
And so let's make it... Let's illegalize it again. So you have the Rockefeller family and the Morgan Bank, which is... Morgan is officially English and American at the same time. You have a Jewish bank, the Kuhn Loeb Bank, which is closely tied to the British royal family directly through Ernst Cassell. And those three, Rockefeller, Morgan, and Kuhn Loeb, nominate and enrich for power Edward Harriman, who's a smaller stock manipulator and so forth, but in this whole apparatus of traders in New York. And he is given control of the Union Pacific Railroad after it was driven into bankruptcy, the old Lincoln's Railroad. And then when he dies, his son, Averill Harriman, is a playboy and so forth, but now in this generation you have pure evil. People born into evil. There's no memory of productive enterprises. Morgan took over productive enterprise. He never made any, but at least he managed some as they were being strangled, like the steel industry. So now, with Harriman and his young friends, George Herbert Walker and then later Prescott Bush, that come into his firm, this is a generation of pure evil. Averill Harriman is a product, is an Anglo-American product. A bank is set up for him. The Bank of Harriman is created by George Herbert Walker.
So who's the grandfather of the current of the?
He's the great grandfather of. He's the father-in-law of Prescott Bush. He's the grandfather of first President Bush and the great grandfather of the second President Bush.
And of Jeb.
He's a great grandfather. Okay, he's the one who creates Harriman's bank. So this is not just that Bush is a minor employee. The Bushes are not powerful like Harriman, but they are willing to do anything to further the interests, the global interests of this criminal gang. That's the important thing.
Okay, so we only have a few minutes left, so let's go quickly, and we're going to have you on for another show because the Bushes are a whole story in themselves, but let's go through this quickly about what the Bushes did so people can see how evil these people
okay.
are.
Okay, in the 1920s and 30s, this grouping, which included an old bank called Brown Brothers that merged in 1931, this grouping was at the very epicenter of the creation of a new power in the world called fascism. It was done in Italy and Germany by this group. And it was done in Japan, largely by Morgan. But the Harriman Bank was at the very center, working directly with the head of the Bank of England to create fascism in Italy and Germany and to build up their war machine. And to deny any kind of forces that would try to choke off Hitler. They protected and developed Hitler as a power over Germany. This was the Prescott Bush as the manager of the slush fund of the Nazi Party in his bank in New York City, mm-hmm. called the Union Banking Corporation. And his son, George Bush Sr., became... was raised during the Depression when all this was going on. So he's privy to all these secrets. The family employees are the brothers Dulles, and they are in the Republican Party. So you have this apparatus of intelligence based on fascism directed from London. That's the inheritance of the Bush family. In 1976, George H.W. Bush was head of CIA for 1 year. on the heritage of the Dulles brothers and Hitler. That's his background.
Okay, we only have a few seconds
His son, left. Jeb, is a banker right after that in Venezuela to do the dirty work of this whole gang as a banker. That's the beginning of Jeb Bush's career.
Okay, we're out of time. We're going to have you back. Now, listeners, you know how bad the Bushes are and what this is about, but we're going to have you back to talk more about this. Thank you so much for coming by, Tony, and talking to us today. You've been listening to The LaRouche Show for Saturday, January 3rd. Thank you very much for tuning in.